The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome to what I think is the 15th night. Let me just check. That's the 14th night of Millennial 2023. And there are four streams. Later on, it'll be the Homeland Institute, then JF, and then Semiogog. But right now, it's the Woodlander. The Woodlander has appeared on Millennial twice before. And both times, I feel like I didn't do right by him. And I felt guilty about it because his project, or what he does, his life is so interesting and worthwhile that we should have talked about that. But the first time he was on, we ended up talking about art college. And then the second time he was on, we talked about the speech that I'd just done, which I think I was very proud of. And I had the feeling that he was the right person to talk about it with. So that's what we did. This third time, however, he's got a project of his own that is doing very well and that is very, very worthwhile. So that's what we're going to be talking about here. So Woodlander, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you very much for having me on, Woz. It's an honour, as always. I'm going to rebut what you've said there. You shouldn't have felt guilty. The first time I was on, it was great. And we had something in common in the fact that we both went to art college at different times, which was interesting. The second time, I think your speech actually laid out an achievable future. But, and was really important and needed to be discussed, dissected, looked at. And I mean, I've sent that speech to several people who, and every single one who has read it, listened to it, has come back and said, that's so far reaching. That's so, I don't want to use the word visionary, but it really was. It showed a future that's possible.
Yeah, and I think it was a desire to do something practical, because people often say that, you know, we talk a lot about theory and we analyze the world an awful lot, and also that a lot of what we say is negative and depressing. So there was an effort to and it was specifically the conference, that was the theme, like what a vision for the future, something positive. So that was what was the remit there. So that was what I was doing. But anyway, why don't we talk about you and the your channel? I think it's been going for about 3 years now.
Yeah, well, the channel kind of started shortly after our 3 year insanity. But my journey had started way before then. Most people watching will know that I'm the weird bloke in England who just ran off and lives in the woods. But they won't really know the backstory. So the backstory is that I came from a right-leaning perspective, and I was a member of smaller far-right political parties, because I had already identified at a very young age that there were problems in society that they needed changing, and they were the people that were speaking sense at that time. However, after a decade, I became disenfranchised with the smaller parties, because it became obvious that there was really no way they were going to be allowed near the levers of power. I then became involved in mainstream politics in the late 90s. So I became a member of the Conservative Party, really at a time where I thought it would be possible to move the Conservative Party further to the right. And if that was possible, that what you could do is get people to join. And at a grassroots level, that is possible. It was possible. The problem arose as I moved up in that organization, ministerial level and and the civil service, it became apparent that there was no way anything could be done, that there was no movement possible.
Let me just intervene here, because was this around the time when you met Margaret Thatcher?
I had dinner with Thatcher twice, Ann Portillo, William Hague, John Bercow, who at the time, remarkably, and we all know Bercow as the Speaker of the House of Commons, but back then he was a much younger MP, was considered far right, a member of the 1922 committee, spoke all the right things. So, yes, I was mixing with these people.
But one other thing I'd say just before is that at this time you were hoping to push the Conservative Party to the right, but at that time it was actually going to the left, because there'd been this dreadful, devastating defeat by New Labour in 97. And I think their conclusion to the Conservatives was, we can't beat them, so we've got to join them. We've got to beat them at their own game of being socially liberal. Sorry. I accidentally muted you. You go. Sorry.
The strange thing was that at grassroots level, everybody wanted to move further to the right. But at ministerial level, it was all about consolidating the system. And as I was looking at this and as I was watching it, there was really no difference between the Labour politicians, the Conservative politicians. It didn't matter for those MPs that they were out of power at all. That made no difference. They were still on the board of directors of companies. They were still having dinner in the House of Commons with Labour MPs who were in power. They were best mates. They were going on holiday together. It was one trough and all the same animals eating out of it. And it became apparent at that level that the system was completely different from politics. Politics is what they show the people. The system is a self-sustaining entity, right? That all it does is perpetuate its own power and its own power base.
If you were to speculate, when do you think this started to be the case? Because in the 80s, I've been doing research, in the 80s it seemed like there was a sort of rivalry between like Kinnock and like it was a genuine ideological divide. But do you think that was an illusion?
I'm going to say it started earlier than that. It started in the 70s. Really, that those two parties started to become ever closer. And I think they were close in the 80s, but in the 90s, they were indistinguishable. And what they all realized was that it didn't matter, like, which one was in power, because they could all still continue. So it was all about then ensuring that the system remained, which is why it was so difficult for the hard left or the hard right to gain any ground, because these people realized that those people would change the system, and that was not going to be allowed. It was difficult. So after that, the small parties wouldn't be allowed near. The main political organizations were corrupt to the core. And I was left thinking, well, if I can't change this system in order to alter the problems I can see around me, my only recourse here is to do the best thing for me, which is to withdraw from that system, to not interact with it in the ways I can. So it started with me shutting down bank accounts and using cash only, which sounds weird, but that was like over 20 years ago I did that. And to look at any other way, so to become self-employed instead of employed, to make myself as self-sufficient as possible so that I had no recourse to anyone else, which eventually led down to the road of going off-grid, buying my own land, and looking at every possible means I could to avoid contact with that system, unless it was in my favor. If I could go into that system and take something from it, I will do. Right? I will work and I will earn money and I will take that back and I will use that for my own means. But I'm not going to give anything to it. It's a corrupt, evil system that I think people now are realizing, right, is totally against them. It's designed to keep you down, to box you in, to control you. And if you're a white person in England, preferably to eradicate you. And you can't have anything to do with it. It's difficult not to, but the best thing would be to have nothing to do with that system.
Yeah, I think this is a dilemma that affects different parts of life where, and we were talking about AI just before we went on air, and there's a dilemma about, is it possible to use it at all without becoming infected by it, without it changing you or changing your project or changing your life, changing your understanding of things? Or can you insulate yourself from that and just take what you need from it, as you said about the system and taking money, but not putting money back into the system kind of thing?
Yeah, it is a dilemma. The AI thing, I'm going to discuss a little bit more in detail later, the problems I see with it. A lot of people think that living the way I do, so I bought some land, I built a cabin. I didn't borrow any money to do it. Whatever I made, I went and bought some stuff that week, and that was what I did. And I built a frame and then put a roof on, and bit by bit, I built it. And then we got some chickens, and then we got some ducks and some turkeys, and then we bought a polytunnel and we started growing some food. And we did this bit by bit. And when I say we, I built it big enough for the whole family, as it was, well, the kids sort of went off and did their thing. So it's me and the wife, seven dogs and a load of cats running around. Right? But it's been an amazing eye opener for me living like this. We touched briefly on like sleeping habits because of the way you're working at the moment. When I first moved here, I moved here on my own. My wife was still living in our house, and I moved in to iron out any bugs and to get things finished. And I had no electricity and no running water. So I could sort of work during the day when it was daylight, and then as it got darker, that was the end of the day, literally. And I had no TV. And I found myself within a relatively short period of time becoming completely in tune with nature. Again, you had no choice, or I had no choice. There wasn't that luxury of switching on a light so I could work longer. It was, okay, it's 8 o'clock, it's getting dark, it's time to, you know, have something to eat and get ready for bed. And I was in bed by 9, which for me was unheard of, because normality for me was a 3-bedroom semi with electric lights, and I put the film on at 8:30 and watch that till, and then watch whatever else was on the telly until 2 o'clock in the morning. Because that was denied to me, I suddenly became much more in tune and felt much better. I got up earlier, I worked longer during those light hours, and then got much more sleep. It was a very odd thing to find how quickly you can actually realize how very little you need. So I cooked my food on the log burner on the top of it. I I carried some water up here on a sort of every 3 or 4 days. And so I didn't need running water. I could still wash. I had a little gas burner, which I used to make coffee on. I could get hot water and I could wash it in that. It was very basic, very simple. Not like it is now. Now I've got everything a normal house has got. But even at that time, that way of living was, it's an eye opener to go from a normal suburban house to living a very basic life. Actually did me no harm, like none.
How long did that period last?
Half a year, 6 months.
Right. And then probably either your wife moved in or otherwise, for whatever reason, you decided to install electricity. You've now got lights on, you're using Wi-Fi, I presume. Being honest, do you miss that 6 month period? You obviously, it sounds like you look back on it with fondness.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do have a wife. I do have a wife. I'll be honest with you, so now I've got a microwave, I've got a massive big American fridge freezer, a washing machine, a tumble dryer, all these things that people think that if you live off grid, you can't have. You can, right? You've just got to work out a way to do it. So I've got solar panels, which is modern technology. I've got an inverter charger, which charges a bank of batteries, which powers the cabin. That's modern technology. So I'm not anti-technology. If I can take that and use it to live a more traditional life, then I'll do it. I'll take it and use it. And it's also something that I can take and use, which doesn't give back to the system. I'm giving nothing back by using this. But yeah, those 6 months were very special. They really were, because it kind of opened me up to an understanding, which is, a lot of the way we live, that in modernity of commercialism and needing things, actually is untrue. And it's not until you do without them that you actually realize you don't need it. You don't. But I do have a wife, so I do need it.
Yeah, I mean, people are very adaptable, and whatever situation you find yourself in, you tend to get used to it. You might not like it, you might resent it, but you can get used to it. So doing the various things that you described becomes perfectly livable. But it sounds like it wasn't quite like that with this. It sounds like it was actually better in a way, because it was a much simpler life, and it taught you, as you said, how little you actually need. So it wasn't so much that you resented it. It sounds like it was actually quite improving in a way.
Yeah, it was. But it's surprising how easy it is to get back into the, oh, well, now we've got that power sorted. We can have the microwave. Now we've got, now we've got enough electricity. We can have a bigger fridge. Now we've got enough of, and little by little, you're kind of, okay, I am off grid, right? But my house is absolutely the same as anybody else's four-bedroom house. Do you know what I mean? Whereas that 6 months without any of that actually taught me how little you actually need. Well, you really don't. And actually, it wasn't difficult. It really wasn't. People say, oh, that must have been awful. And I'm like, well, really? Why? Why? Instead of running a tap, I poured a bottle. So, I mean, it's not that different. And instead of putting my meals in an oven, I put them on top of the log burner. It wasn't a big thing to get used to. And instead of staying up until 2 a.m. watching Netflix, I went to bed at 10 and got up earlier when the sun got up. And it was a different way of living. But even now, it's completely different from living in suburbia when you're up here. It's incredibly different.
Well, what do you mean?
to be able to open my front door and see a deer on my deck, literally, that doesn't run away because it has no need to run away. It doesn't really, it's just looks at you. And the wildlife and the environment, it is incredible. So I get up in the morning, if I go and feed the chickens, we've got about 120 chickens and 5 turkeys and ducks and quail. And people think that's hard work, but it isn't really. You get a big bucket of food, you go round, you feed them, you get to know them. You know which one. I've got chickens I know, which we've named. I'm not going to go into details, but they'll jump up on your shoulder and they'll try and eat the food out of the bucket. You've got the cocky ones. You know, you've got the big cockerels that round up all the other birds as soon as they see you come in. It's really enjoyable. It's a completely different way of life. It really is. And personally, I don't think I could ever go back to living in that 3-bed semi in suburbia. I don't think I could ever do it.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be a real a change in a negative direction. I mean, what you said about how it's easy to give up this stuff piece by piece, to like the purity of that first 6-month period, it reminded me of when I was 18, and I got into swimming, and I'd never been an exercise type before, but I got into swimming and I got really toned, like ridiculous. I mean, at 18 it's easy to do this, you know, you can have a rock hard stomach and all this fairly easily, and so I did that, and I changed my diet. I stopped smoking, stopped drinking Coke, stopped eating sugar, like chocolate and whatever. It was really good for about 6 months. And then something went wrong. I know that there was a frightening experience at the swimming pool where I don't like going into it, but I saw a human shit in the swimming pool, and that kind of traumatized. I just didn't want to go back, and I had to force myself to go back to that swimming pool after that. And then another thing, a separate incident happened, which put me off again. But that was one thing. But then the healthier eating as well. You're very slim, you're toned, you're healthy. Everyone's telling you you look fucking great, your skin's glowing and all this. And that did happen. Again, I was 18. And it did happen. And then you think, okay, I can afford to relax a bit and have a bar of chocolate. and then gradually, piece by piece. This is why with the smoking, which I gave up, obviously I resumed, the reason that happened was I went to Amsterdam, which, I mean, what's going to happen? You know, when you're 18, 19 and you go to Amsterdam, yeah, the vice is it all around you. So I resumed smoking there. But then I gave it up many years later, like 2020. And this time I know it's giving up is one thing, but the second danger is getting back into it by giving yourself a break. Just don't do it. Just don't do it, because it's so much easier to resist that temptation than it is to eliminate the vice in the first place. So I know about the slippery slope thing. Yeah, for sure.
It's so much of life is like that. It's poisoned by increments. That one bit doesn't do you any harm, but 2 bits, that's okay. It's only 1 bit more than the last bit. And 3 bits, well, that's only 1 bit more than what you were doing last week. And before you know it, it's too much.
You're a fucking full-time smoker again, and all the rest. Yeah. This is why the cigarettes, a cigarette has not touched my lips since May 2020, and it never will again.
What happens is people go and they have a drink and they're out with mates and they say, oh, I'll just have one on a Friday. And one on a Friday leads to a packet on a Friday, and a packet on a Friday. And then you're like, well, I'm smoking again anyway. Why not do it? Before you know it, you're back doing it full time. But that is life. And this is what I was on about earlier. When I say the system is designed, the system we live in this country, and I dare say it's the same for every Western nation, our system is designed, right, to keep you ill, to keep you weak, to keep you controlled. They do this.
Addicted
they,
as well.
They do this through the food, they do this through medication, they do this through indoctrination through the television and through the education system, right? It's designed that way so that people are weak, ill, and indoctrinated, so they're much easier to control. That's fairly obvious. If I was running things, that's the population I would want, a docile, sickly, dependent population. They're very easy to control. So you've got to break out of that. And what I did was break out. With my channel, when I was talking about how I lived, people were obviously interested. I was contacted by a lot of people who wanted to do the same thing. Now, I'll be honest with you, I think the whole COVID fiasco woke a lot of people up to wanting to get away from the system. They saw how bad it could get and wanted to break out. So I helped over the period of 2 years. I helped 20 individuals, so that's 20 families, buy land, build cabins, and start living off grid, because I'd done it and I could explain how to do it and what to look for and the pitfalls to avoid. So that was 20 individuals. I then started working with groups of people who wanted to do it on a larger basis, which is a whole different ball game in this country, because planning regulations, planning law, rightly so, I've got to say, right, because it's only a small country, are very strict. You can't just buy land and build somewhere. You're not allowed. Right? There are ways around it. But if you try to do it as a group, 10 people, 20 people, if you bought a little piece of land and put up 20 cabins, like, people would notice straight away and they'd say you've got to take them down. It's different in places like America because the land is so vast. I'll touch on that later. So here, I was being contacted by lots of people that wanted to do it as a community, which is a brilliant idea. So we had to come up with a way of doing that, which we did, which was good. And it was legal and it's above board. And then we started to look at buying land. And this was a massive eye-opener, because what we found was that the land was rising massively in price. Rapidly. And when we looked at that, we found out that it was corporations that were buying the land. A lot of it.
See, this emerged during COVID, where you heard about billionaires and corporations and Lloyds Bank, actually, in Britain, buying up whole swathes of land. And it's frightening. Yeah, go into it.
You know, but there's a lot of reasons for it. I mean, the greenwashing thing was a huge part. So these companies were being told, listen, you're going to have to offset your carbon. And you can do that by buying a woodland. Buy a woodland. Because that sequesters so much carbon, you can now carry on using your fleet of cars. And your, is it ESG rating, is actually brilliant because you've offset all your carbon. And then they were saying, well, actually, it doesn't have to be a woodland.
Yeah, it can be people, oh, God. Damn, there was a phrase, papal indulgences, where you can offset your sin by paying some money, kind of thing.
Yeah. But this is how ludicrous it was. That woodland was there anyway. Like, it literally made no difference, apart from they now own it. So their carbon, what, doesn't exist anymore? Of course it does. It actually makes no difference. It's just box ticking. And then they said, it doesn't have to be woodland. A field sequesters carbon in the soil. So just buy a couple of acres. In fact, buy 100 acres. So that they were just buying this land and they're not using it at all. just fencing it off so the public can't use it, the farmers can't use it, and they're not interested in using it. They just bought it for nothing. It got to the point where people that were selling the land, large landowners, farmers, you'd have a farmer in Devon. He'd want to sell a bit of land to get some money together for whatever. It might be his daughter's wedding, or he was saying, I'm going to sell a couple of acres. His neighbours would be saying to him, don't you be selling that to them corporations up from the big smoke. Like, we don't want no wind turbines, we don't want no solar panels, and we don't want it just being fenced off and not used. Sell it to someone local who's going to use it. Like, you know, Nelly down the road with a pony, she can put a pony in there. And he would have to live in that community, so he was going to listen to them. So he was selling it to Nelly, who lived one town over, or so he thought. But the Nelly from one town over was actually just a holiday let. That was the address in Cornwall. And the person there was on the board of directors at Clean Easy in London, which is, again, so these large corporations weren't just buying it in their name. They were buying it in individuals' names so that the farmers would sell it to them. Because they didn't want to sell it to the big corporation, so they'd sell it to an individual, and preferably someone local. So they'd have individuals in these holiday lets that they would use as an address, and then it would go straight back to the corporation. It was incredible what we were finding out. But it was getting to the stage where we were like, well, we'd put in like 9 bids on land. And we were outbid every single time. And we were going well above it. It would be an £80,000 plot of land. We'd put in £95,000 and it would sell for £190,000. And we were like, this is insane. But once these corporations say, we'll buy that bit, it doesn't matter what the price is. To them, it really doesn't matter. It's just... So we were like, right, we're going to have to rethink the whole thing. And I sat down and I was like, look, this is wrong on so many levels. What these people are doing, right, is they are actually denying the farmers the ability to grow food. And they're buying them out, right? They're buying the farmers out. They're just making them offers that is nearly impossible to refuse. They're saying, we'll have your land, and, you know, for wind farms. Scotland especially, the wind farms, the 600 wind farms planned for next year. 600. And they're buying thousands of acres of land, right, where people live. And they're just buying them out, demolishing the homes. And for every person that says, no, we're not going to sell, they say, okay, you're going to be surrounded by 400 of these disgusting turbines, though. And in the end, they sell. Because, one, they don't want to live there. And two, how on earth are you ever going to sell that? It's like, who wants to? So they sell. They sell up.
And probably at a knockdown price as well, because no one else would
again,
buy it.
Again, it seems to be, right, that money is no object. They're paying these people over the odds for their property. They're just saying, how much is the house worth? 300,000. Here's 600,000. And most people are just taking it, rubbing their hands and thinking, we got a good deal. We'll, you know. But it's very short-sighted. What happens is you've now got no land, like none. It can't be farmed. You can't feed yourself. Which to our government, to our system, makes no difference. We'll just buy our food from somewhere else then. We'll just import it. If you're not self-sufficient, you're reliant on someone else. And that's really, really dangerous. It's dangerous for an individual. It's massively dangerous for a nation. And that's the situation we're in. So I said, look, we have to do something. We have to buy the land ourselves. And I thought, well, I can't do this. I can't do it. I mean, I'm a man of, you know, some means, but like, I can't just go and keep on buying land. I haven't got the money. And my idea initially was, if I can get 1,000 people to put in £1,000, that's £1 million. Now, with that million, we can make a start, right? We can actually start to buy woodlands. We can buy meadows, which these people will never get. And we can use. It's a brilliant investment for the people. It's our land. It's ours. We can use it at the same time. It just made so much sense. And everyone was kind of the same thing, which is actually this makes loads of sense. We can use this for allotments. We can use this for rearing livestock. For those that just want to take somewhere to go for a weekend, it's ours. We can go there. We've got our own woodlands. We've got our own meadows. We can go walking. We can go camping. We can have hold events there. We can put a marquee up and have a conference there. No one's going to shut it down. It's ours. And it all made sense. So I spent a bit of time. I got some advice on the best way to put it together. So it meant building a private members club. A private members club can't buy land, so I had to start up a limited company, link the two together, and then put it out to people and say, right, yeah, kind of here it is. This is a British organization to buy our own land back for ourselves. Who wants a part?
And this is what is known as the Woodlander Initiative.
Yeah.
And this was launched, well, when was it launched?
6 months ago, end of June. And so 6 months, and in 6 months we've managed to raise £100,700, which some people will say, though, that's not a lot. For me, I was gobsmacked at the response in the first 6 months. We're on an idea. We've not bought land. Now, I say we haven't bought land. We've put in an offer. It's been accepted. It's now with the solicitors. It's Christmas time. We probably won't hear back till January and to complete the sale, but it's a done deal. But for people to listen to what we had to say, which was, we need to do something. We need to step outside of the box. We need to put together an organization that is ours, that's going to give us a possibility of having access to our own land. Because in reality, what they want is to deny that. We see that every day, right, with the restrictions in things like car ownership, with the restrictions on travel, with restrictions on, you know, everything, 15-minute cities or 20-minute neighborhoods. What they love to do is keep us boxed right in. And I could talk for ages about that, right? But
well,
we don't.
It's a huge thing about the pod, and you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And yeah, it wasn't an official policy, but it obviously reflects a certain mentality that they have. Otherwise, it simply wouldn't have ended up on the website. And it tallies with what they're saying publicly as well. So they want everything on a subscription service, which means that you really don't own anything that you use. It's all rented.
It's nearly there. It's nearly there now. If you look at something like car ownership, which is going to be, I mean, in 2030, so no new petrol, no new diesel cars, the second-hand car markets, it'll collapse, and then it'll be astronomically high. Until they get rid of the second-hand cars, which it won't be difficult. I was told this 2 years ago by a friend of mine who's still in mainstream politics, and he said, what will happen? I said, look, there's no way these electric cars are going to work. And he said, no, they're not going to work. What they want is you off the road. Well, that's the plan. You won't be driving. They will introduce electric cars. A lot of people will buy them. There will be no infrastructure. It's not gonna spread out like they're telling you. You won't be able to charge them all the time, and there won't be the electricity to charge them anyway. So it's a bit of a duck egg. Petrol cars and diesel cars, although the second-hand cars will still be there, when it's £20 a litre, you won't be able to afford to run it at all. To get into town in your car is going to cost you 40 quid. It's like...
Yeah, it's a useless investment.
So it's... And it's just a way. It's a way of... The British government's very good at this, right? They won't tell you, hey, you can't drive. They will just make it impossible for you to drive. And then say, we're not banning it. You can still do it. Until the point comes where nobody's doing it. It's much the same with cash. I find this daily. I run a cash business, so I only accept cash. And it's becoming really hard, right? Because 2 years ago, we had 6 banks in my local town. We've got one, and that's planning on closing in January. So there'll be no bank. So if you run a cash business, where do you you can't put your money in? And you can only bank £250 a day. And you can only take out £250 a day. So if something's £300, how do you pay for it? Well, you take out £250 and you've got to wait till the next day to get. And in the end, people stop using cash because they just make it so hard that people stop. And then they've got the reason to come to you and say, well, listen, no one's used it. In a year, no one. So obviously no one wants to, so we're going to get rid of it. And that's the way the British government are very good at doing this. And they'll do it with transport. Access to the land is being denied massively all of the time. National parks are getting larger, and at the same time restricting the amount of space available to the public. So they'll buy another 500 acres, but you can't go there because that's an environmental zone. And obviously we don't want you walking on the flowers or upsetting the birds. So it's just taking away more land all the time that you can actually go to. And they counter this with the Agenda 30 program, which says that within a 15-minute city or 20-minute neighbourhood, you must have green spaces. And you think, well, that sounds quite good. So my local town has identified a large area which they've designated the green space, which isn't a playground or a park. It's just green fields. And you think, well, that's brilliant. Until you realise it wasn't theirs. It doesn't belong to the council. It was owned by 3 private individuals who said, well, hang on a minute. What do you mean that's Warminster's green space? Well, that's not yours. That's ours. And they said, yeah, but it doesn't need to be ours. We've now designated that as the green space for this town. And you can never develop it. And you can't do anything with it unless we tell you. And the private owner said, well, this isn't accessible to the public. It's private land. And this is the catch. They said, we don't need the public to have access to it at all. All we need to do is tick the box to say that we've got a green space. So in the literature, it sounds great, doesn't it? Every place has got its own green open spaces, and you can see it on the video. Look, here it is. Look at this lovely area.
This reminds me of something Theodore Dalrymple reported about the NHS, where they had too many hospital beds. I've forgotten how this was, but basically they got around a numerical disgrace by simply changing what was regarded as a bed. So that then, I think it was something like you... patients are having to wait too long on a hospital bed before they get seen. So what they did was they put them on stretchers in the corridor so that they weren't on a hospital bed. So then that time didn't count. I think that was the issue. And it's an example of, creative accounting, creative documenting of things so that you can get away with stuff. You just sort of reauthor the reality.
Yeah, but that's what they do all of the time. I think 2023 has been a weird year because we came out of that sort of whole COVID thing, which for me, it was nothing to do with like a virus or scary this or scary that. They did things which annoyed me and which annoyed most people or a lot of people. What actually really frightened me was when I saw how interconnected and how large and capable the system was, because before that I'd seen this as separate national systems that had some interconnectivity, but nothing like what I saw there, where a global system was put into place with no argument, no government. I say none. There was a few, right? But they were just bulldozed over. Globally, every government towed the line, did what they were told, locked down. And it's weird that people forget how harsh and how utterly draconian what happened was. They locked you in your house. They denied you access to your family. They shut down your business if you're self-employed. They told you how far you could stand next to someone. They limited, right, what you could purchase, even if you could get into a shop unless you obeyed rules. I had seen nothing like that. And if that had happened in one country, right, I would have been shocked. But to see it happen on a global level and how that whole system was already in place, for me, was a massive eye-opener. And it kind of just reinforced my belief that a political route to change was really, how do you fight something that big? Right? You can't fight it. So the idea is walk away from that, right? Get away from that and build something better. Build something ourselves, because people are going to need an alternative. When they realize what's happening, they will be looking for an alternative. We can't wait until that time and then start building it. We need to start now. What's been really encouraging in 2023 is I'm seeing that happen. I'm seeing publishers starting. I'm seeing writers starting writing on our side. I'm seeing filmmakers. You were discussing with Dangerfield about making films. I'm seeing people explore Substack and new ideas. I'm seeing businesses start. Are people starting businesses? I'm seeing lots of positive energy that is not being ploughed into politics, but being ploughed into culture and a separate society. What I've done is in that vein, which is we need to become powerful. The way to do that is not through politics, right, but to become an organization of our own, to buy our own land, to own. If I walked into the council as an individual, right, and start trying to tell them what to do, they don't listen. They don't listen. If I walk in there as a multi-million pound corporation, guess what happens? This is why Tesco's can build wherever they want. So we need to become that. And I can't do that on my own, but I can tell you what, if all of us get together, which is what we've already started, and everyone puts in a little bit, suddenly, right, in 6 months, we've got over 100,000. Now, if a few more get involved, we could have 250,000. a few more get involved, we've got a million. With that million, we double that in a year. We got 2 million. Now we're a multi-million pound corporation straight away. That could be 3 years away. We haven't got that on our side at the moment. We can't keep looking for it. We need to build it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I think it's a great idea. I think it's a terrific initiative. And I want people to get involved. Let me just check whether I did include the URL for the... No, I included only the your channels, your social media. Hold on a second. I'm going to get the URL for the Woodlander Initiative just for anyone who wants to get involved, get on board. I think... And this is something I wanted to ask you about how it actually works. But before we get to that, I want to address something that was said in the chat, which is interesting. And again, the person who said this, please don't feel attacked. I just think that your comment is worth addressing. Someone said, blaming everything on the system is lefty commie talk. And now, well, first of all, here's the link for the Woodlander Initiative. So, okay, now blaming everything on the system is lefty commie talk. The trouble is, I understand what you're saying there, but the trouble is that the system really is corrupt. And you're assuming that it's not, and therefore that people who say it is are off the left. They've got these utopian delusions, they're emotionally immature, and so they're blaming the world. What if you actually do live in a corrupt world and with a system that really is bent against the public? Then, well, you can't say that to comment on that is to be a lefty commie. It's just, you're just stating the reality. Woodlander, would you like to address this?
You're right. That's a lefty statement. Blaming stuff on the system is traditional left, right? The problem we've got at the moment is it's the left that are the system at the moment. It's, and not just the left, it's, it is a corrupt. And until you've been through, I mean, when I say I started off on the right and I went through, so I was listening to John Tyndall and these early speakers of right-wing parties, and I was consuming literature, which in the early 80s was difficult to get hold of. I was reading Gothic Ripples by Colin Jordan and consuming all stuff. So I knew it. They were telling me back then, this system's corrupt, capitalism's corrupt, commercialism's corrupt, the left is exactly the same and just as bad. Not until I actually got to ministerial level and was hanging out with these ministers, did I actually get to understand that. Right, that actually it's not a political party that's corrupt. It's the actual overarching system.
Yeah, the the whole culture of Westminster.
Yes, but not just Westminster. As you zoom out, you see that these people are talking with the governments in Germany. And the government and the system in Germany is exactly the same. What they've discovered is that you can have two or three parties and you can juggle them, right? And they'll all work together and they're all mates, right? And some will leave and some will join. And as long as you don't rock that boat, you'll be welcome at the trough. But no one that's going to change that system, right, is ever going to get near it. It's huge. And now what we saw 3 years ago is that that system is actually really interlinked and can spread out and people obey. All of these governments didn't suddenly come to those ideas themselves. There was a script. They were told what to say. They were told what to do. And they all agreed, all of them.
Yeah, the lockstep, the unity, the harmony. I think that was what was so frightening during COVID, that it was as if they'd worked it all out. They'd all agreed on everything, every detail beforehand. Whether it was the museums, the doctors, the lawyers, the lobbyists, the politicians, the civil servants, the scientists, whoever it was, they were all in bizarre agreement that we've got to go into lockdown, we've got to wear masks, we've got to do social distancing, the virus is very serious, the vaccine works, etc.
Come to light now, especially in this country, we know that none of those politicians thought this was real. They all knew it was fake and gay, like the whole thing. They understood what they had to do. They'd been told what they had to do, so they'll go ahead and do it. But none of them thought this was real. They were still having parties and not wearing masks and like whatever. They knew it was rubbish. So it kind of says to me that everyone in power, in Germany, in Finland, in America, they all knew this was rubbish, but they still did it.
Well, there's the famous photo of them Downing Street, taking it easy and drinking. I'm sure they're having a really nice time, drinking fine wine and whatever. Clearly not scared. Clearly not scared at all. And I don't blame them for not being scared. I blame them for making everyone else scared, for terrorizing the public. I mean, that's what's just fucking gross about all of this. And pardon me for swearing, but they did separate families. They did prevent, you know, old grannies from seeing their grandkid for the last time. I mean, it's absolutely awful. I even had an experience myself where I visited a relative and I had to wear the mask and she didn't recognize me. I shouldn't go into that. I shouldn't go into that because I'll get emotional. But, in some ways, I wasn't that affected by the whole thing because of my lifestyle anyway. Other people were affected a hell of a lot worse than I was, but God, I mean, it did affect everyone. And this is what they did to us.
I think it's important, right? Because I wouldn't have started the Woodlander Initiative if none of this was happening. So there's always a why. Right. And yes, it's great for us to get together and buy land that we can use for ourselves. It's great to protect our own land, right, from what they're doing to it. It really is. I mean, that's a good thing. But more than that, we've got to look at what do they intend to do? And I can tell you now, right, that whole COVID thing was like they learned a lot from that. Right, and they knew it was rubbish and they still did it. They got a lot of data from that. They know how people react to being paid less money than they were earning, right, whilst not working. So they've worked out what people would be like on a UBI. So many things. They've learned how many people will push back against something, how many people will just go ahead with it. How many people will mouth off and still go ahead with it? They know everything, right down to the real hard cases that didn't take the vaccine. They've got your name and they've got your address, right? Because
and they know how the other 99% will react to you.
Yeah.
That's crucial information for them.
Yeah, so much information. But why would they need that information? Now, this is just, here's an idea. I said 2 years ago that none of this, right, was thought up in a smoky back room by a gang of blokes, right? Even a gang of evil blokes. This has been gameplayed to the eighth degree. And to do that, they're going to use a computer programs, and the most powerful computer programs they've got at the moment is AI. That's without a doubt. If you wanted to write a, like Dangerfield was saying the other night, if you want to write a script or if you want to know something, all you've got to do is type it in, right, and it will give you the best scenario. How does it know the best scenario? Because it can access pretty much what's on the internet. It can get all these variables. It can put them all together. Now, if I was in charge and I wanted an outcome, Doesn't matter what that outcome is. If I said, this is what I want, what's the best way to do it? And here's all the information we've got on everyone. And they've got everything. If you look at what's available just from social media, and now all the information they gathered from COVID as well, that's the outcome we want. What's the best way to do it? What program would you use? Because it's not going to be a 10 blokes sat around a table going, I wonder what's the best way to do this. That's not how these organizations work.
It's not going
to
be like an Amiga from the 80s and you're going to type it in.
I honestly believe a lot of people think, oh, you know, they're just dreaming these ideas up. That they don't dream ideas up. Businesses don't do that. If you've got a business plan, right, nowadays, do you think the CIA just, you know, think things up? They plow it through and they've got all the information from Interpol and everything, and it's a massive computer and it spits out the best way to do something. Exactly the same way these people will be going, this is the end goal we want. What's the best way to do it? And here's all, and it will come out with, like, here's all the variables. Here's what you should be doing to get some more information. You plow that in and this is the route we'll take. Now, they could say, yeah, we don't agree with this amazing computer that gets everything else right, but it's much more likely they'll go, actually, that ticks all the boxes. So let's just go with it. And that answers one of the questions that has been asked for the last 3 years, which is everything they're doing seems inhuman. It doesn't seem human. It seems completely at odds with humanity. It's unnatural. It's anti-nature. It's just weird what they're doing. Why would they do? Because I honestly don't believe it's people thinking up these ideas. I think they're going along with what's been spat out from a program. The same as Google, that don't go through every single thing. Oh, this bloke said this. There's not a gang of men. It may have been in the originally someone watching every video, right? But they can't do that. So it's a computer program. It's an algorithm that tells you you're banned for a week because you used the word COVID too many times. It's an algorithm. And then you might get someone go and check things if they have to, right? Even that's rare. That's a rarity. Usually it's just a computer program. And that's where I think all of this is coming from.
At any rate, it's being enacted by people who clearly think like computers. I mean, they don't have human concerns anymore. So even if it's not coming from an AI, it's coming from human husks.
Yeah, but they don't see themselves the same as us. They really don't. They see themselves as completely separate from us, completely like they're nothing like us. And it's wealth and power that does it. I had this conversation with someone the other day, and they said, you know, the root to power is still through politics. And I was like, who are the most powerful people in the world at the moment? You know,
it's not the politicians.
No. So you would say someone like Elon Musk is quite powerful. He's controlling a narrative through X without a doubt. You would say someone like Klaus Schwab seems to be quite powerful, but none of these people are politicians. You would say Bill Gates is quite powerful. Now, these people are in positions of power because they're incredibly wealthy, not because they're intelligent in any particular field. I mean, Bill Gates was intelligent as a computer programmer. But how does that make him good at vaccines or good at buying 40% of American farmland? It's like,
there's not particular reason to doubt that he's intelligent. It's the fact that it's not his intelligence that makes him powerful. It's his wealth. It's his astounding wealth.
Yeah. But that's the same all over, isn't it? We know that organisations like Vanguard and BlackRock are incredibly powerful, much more powerful than most governments, because they're wealthy. So I said to somebody, the same chap who said, you know, the route to power is through politics. And I said, the route to power is through wealth, right, is through being a wealthy organization would be much more powerful, right, than being a political organization. So that's another step that we can take.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking that maybe in the case, because I'm thinking about the AfD in Germany, and I'm thinking maybe they actually, that is a route to power. That's clearly what the other parties are terrified of. They're terrified of the AfD. Now, in Britain, we don't, well, it's the voting system makes that much less likely that there's going to be any new party that threatens the status quo, that threatens the strong, the hold of Labour and Conservative. But I think the other thing is that is Anglo-individualism, which means that the path to power is not going to be through politics. It's going to be through wealth in a way that in Germany is probably less the case. I think in Germany, this, and I might be wrong about this. I'm not investing anything particularly in this statement. I'm just speculating that I think in Germany, the AfDs or something similar, that could actually threaten the status quo. But I think in the Anglosphere, it's more likely just to be raw wealth. And another example there would be Donald Trump. And I know that Donald Trump is ensconced in various ways and whatever, but only someone with his wealth, his personal wealth, could have done even what he did. So that's just my thoughts there.
Yeah, you're right. I think in Germany, the AfD, because of their political system, have got a route to power there. But what difference on a global scale they would be allowed to have, right, remains to be seen. And I think we saw this with Trump, and I think we saw this with Brexit, which were two things they didn't want, they didn't like, and what happened? So Trump was just like deplatformed, got rid of. And if you can't get rid of him the right way, we'll just fake the next election. Brexit, they just ignored. Just completely ignored it and carried on as normal. We're still giving millions of pounds to Europe. Nothing really changed apart from a bit more bureaucracy for imports and exports. But nothing changed. It's like, so they just ignored it. And I think, like, if the AfD got in Germany, they may be able to do something in Germany. But how far do you go before you're a pariah nation? It's like, because that's, and I said this over here as well, we got a right-wing government over here. Depending on how far we want to go, we would first need to be self-sufficient. Because without that, what happens if they just shut off your food and you can't feed yourself? Then everyone in the country starves. Self-sufficiency is majorly important. We should be self-sufficient on energy and food. 100%. We were just over 80% self-sufficient in food in the 1980s. We should be well 100% by now. But instead, we're below 50%. Because we shut down more and more and more of our own businesses, our own farms, and just started buying stuff from abroad. Insane.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we've talked about this before and just how nuts it is to be reliant on other countries, especially for, I remember making the point about pharmaceuticals, that we need pharmaceuticals from China. So we can't afford to fall out with China. I mean, it's insane. But in terms of food, absolutely. I mean, why? What is wrong with the idea? How is it not a beautiful idea that Britain grows all its food itself, that the British grow all their food themselves? I think that's a really nice idea. I think, and in the same with any other country, accepting exotic novelties, obviously, that you'd want to get from, you know, Parmesan from Italy or whatever. But other than that, I mean, why would you not want to be growing everything in your own country? Yeah, I mean, this links to my essay, Scottish Hospital Food, from earlier this year, where I made this point that I think it's more, it jives more with people, their psychology. I think they like the idea of self-sufficiency on a national scale and also on an individual scale. I think it just appeals to people. Well, to most people, anyway.
Well, I think it makes sense to anyone with any sort of mental faculty, which is, well, it's best if you can look after yourself, then look after yourself and not have someone else do it, or not being reliant on someone else. That's on an individual basis, and certainly on a country. The weird thing is, right, it would be really, really simple for a government to encourage this, right, on a national level, and watch the population become energized in achieving it, right? Because they really would, because they would understand it intrinsically, right? It would be a way of generating patriotism and nationalism, right? But not in a political direction. So for a government, it'd be a really good way to energize the people, you know, to get people back growing food themselves, open up more allotments, and to get people buying British food, right, would be a really simple thing to do, right? If they wanted to do it, if they really wanted to do it, a little bit of propaganda, a little bit of marketing, right, and the whole population would be behind that. Oh, but they've gone so far the other way.
Yeah, I think it's something that would just appeal to people naturally. Yeah. I can imagine some young, especially like a young guy, like a boy, like a 15-year-old boy, thinking, okay, I've been relying on my mum and dad all my life. Now I'm going to have an allotment. I'm going to grow my own vegetables. I'm going to learn how to be a man and self-sufficient. That would really appeal to that emerging man in him. But all sorts of people. I mean, some guy in his 20s who's realised he's...
And then you offer small rewards for people that do it. You know, if you can grow one bag of potatoes in your first year, right, you'll get this, which will give you and it's a reward-based system. It's easy to do. I know this, Woz, you know this, right? And if we can figure that out, they've already figured it out, but they don't do it. And you've got to think, well, why wouldn't they do that? And it's because it's nothing to do with national pride in this country. It's nothing to do with the good of the people. It's to do with maintaining power in a system which is there to control you, right, and confine you. And as long as they've controlled you and confined you, right, that's it. That's all they're really concerned about. It's really annoying. And as time goes on, I think more and more people on the dissident right are recognizing that what we have to do is build our own structures, businesses, culture again, right, and promote it and use it. We can't rely on these outsiders. We can't rely on the system to ever change. We need to build it again. And I can see it happening, right? Things like Imperium Press and the books they're publishing, things like, things like Substack in some way, although that's not a distant right thing, but the writings that are going on there and being allowed to be published, right? So you've got publishing houses, you've got people online publishing. X is a step in the right direction insofar as voices are now being heard. And I realize it's not perfect, and I realize not everyone's back, and there are still people being kicked off, but it's a step in the right direction. But the more we build ourselves and the more people support it, millennial, right, 9 years is now an institution in our sphere. Without a doubt, it's an institution, right? It's well known, it's well loved, it's well received, right? It gives so much, right? It gives so much. People should support it. I know Dangerfield gave you a big up at the end, but I'll say it again now, right? People should support this financially, and it doesn't need to be a lot. People think, oh, more, you know, it's going to cost more. Send a pound. Send a couple of quid, right? Less than you would spend on a pint of beer, because you're getting so much. And it is the beginning of a whole separate society, ours, the one we're building, right? We need things like this.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. I think it would be worth getting back to the Woodlander Initiative to really introduce that, because I wanted to ask how it's how decisions are made, for example, like that kind of thing. Who decides we're going to buy this piece of land, we're going to sell that, etc.? How does all of that work? I think these are questions that people will have about when they're considering whether to get involved.
Well, let me just explain the structure. So first, we have a private members club, which you can join. It's not much; it's a tenner. To join that, you need to agree to a certain set of principles, which are basically that this is a British organisation, which is put in place to help the British people. It's a non-political organisation. Again, we don't have a political affiliation. We also put in there that we recognise the British as a distinct group made up of the English, Welsh, Scottish, and Irish. Now, as long as you can agree to these things, that this is a British organisation set up to help the British people, that it's non-political, and that the British are a distinct group, then you can join. The idea is that we will buy land throughout the whole of the United Kingdom. So that's in 50, I think it's 54 counties. So there's a way to go. And it doesn't have to be 10 acres or 20 acres. It could just be a one acre plot in a county to start with, by which we could have an area set aside for amenity, so for camping or maybe courses, permaculture courses, something like that, or just a day out, somewhere to take the kids and have a kick around with a football. And some set in every piece of land, there will be land set aside right for growing food and keeping livestock, because people need to get back to know how to do that. So we want to do that throughout the whole United Kingdom. Now, we need to start somewhere. I've had a lot of people say, where are you going to buy the first piece of land? Well, I'll tell you what, wherever the best piece of land becomes available at the right price, right, that we can buy. That's the thing at the moment. So we've identified two pieces of land that are very close to each other. One's a woodland, one's a meadow, which gives us the ability to do many things. So we can run bushcraft courses, we can run permaculture courses, we can have marquees on the meadow, so we can hold functions there, we can have allotments, we can have camping. There's so much we can do with two separate plots, but right near each other. I've had the argument, which is, well, you know, I would get involved, but only if the land's near me. And I'm like, well, this probably isn't for you because you've missed the point. Right, we need to start somewhere. It might be next door to you, but it might be 100 miles away. And the next one might be 100 miles in the other direction. And the next one might be 100 miles in that direction. But you know what? Eventually, the money you're putting in helps these people, and the money they're putting in will help you when we get it near you.
This is a classic case of a high tide raises all ships. So the money might not immediately, probably wouldn't immediately result in a place near you being bought. But eventually, the cumulative effect of all this will result in enough wealth being there that a plot near you can be bought. That's the idea.
I've also get a lot of people who do get that, who understand that like straight off. They also say, I don't care if it's 200 miles away. What a fantastic weekend away I'll have. I'll leave on the Friday. I'll go down there. I'll take my tent. Hopefully there'll be other people around, some growing food. Well, I can get to meet them, other members. All of us have the same mind. All of us on the same page. And that'll be a great weekend away for me. Right. So it doesn't matter where it is. The fact that it's ours, this is our land, and all we're doing is taking it back in a legal way. You know, it's a shame that we have to spend money to do it, right? But what we're doing is taking our land back.
Yeah. So to get back to how it works, and who makes the decisions, and how well, are they made?
We're just setting up regions at the moment as well, so there'll be regional organizations. So at the moment, it's me and one other who are looking at land, and we do have members going out as well. We've got members that are coming out and helping us, taking soil samples and giving. Well, they're going to look at land as well and reporting back and saying, "Well, you know, I went to look at this woodland." They do a little video, and then we'll put it up on the website, and then people will vote on it as well. So I tend to put all the land up and then get feedback from the members. So I'll put a video up and say there's all the brochures, if there are brochures available. They can look at it, and I get feedback from the members of the club. And they say, "I really like this one, I really like that." So I get, you know, 50 want this one, 100 like this one, 200 like this one. And now I've got to weigh it up as well. So, you know, we tend to go on how many people want what area or what piece of land, and then we see what's the best way forward. So it's kind of a bit of everything, Colin, right? Which is what works best, I find. If we had a hard and fast rule, like, okay, we're going to vote on it. Well, a voting system can take like months, and I need to move next week to get to the deal. It's like I can put the vote up, I can take a rough idea, and now I've got to put in an offer. Otherwise, we lose it. So it's got to be done the next day. That was difficult for some people to understand as well, which is, oh, hang on, I didn't see a brochure on that one. And I'm like, well, there wasn't a brochure. This was something a member sent us from someone he knew that was selling some land. We've been down, we've had a look, but they want an answer tomorrow. So I've said, actually, it's a nice piece of land, we'll have that. As it was, that one didn't come off. But some people need to realise that that is how it will work. You know, it will work. We will buy the land in these areas the best way possible. Sometimes they'll be advertised online. Sometimes it'll be private sales. When we can show you where they are, we will do. We will ask you to vote on them. But if a quick decision needs to be made, a quick decision will be made. And that's it. And people have to have a certain degree of trust that we're going to buy a piece of land that is useful.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. This really comes down, you'll have a democratic style sort of decision when you can. But a lot of the time, this is going to come down to trust in you and your assistants to make the right decisions. Pure democracy just isn't tenable for something like this. It just simply wouldn't work.
It's not. So it's set up with the private members club, and then if you're a member, you can buy shares. Because what I wanted to do is to build something that people actually owned. So you own it. So I said, okay, you can buy shares, and they're £1. Right, so they're nothing really, right? And you can buy them 10 at a time. So £10 will buy you 10 shares. As soon as you're a shareholder, right, you've got, you know, voting rights and everything in the AGM and whatever on how you want to structure this business, and you'll be listened to. I don't mind doing that. That's only right and proper. But that really was the way I saw that people can be invested. And I think you touched on this the other night, which is I think people have been not only removed physically from the land, but spiritually. They don't see this country as their land. They just don't. They think of it as, you know, just the same as any other country. It's just a country. They're not invested in it. If you want someone to fight for something, they need to be invested in it. They need it to be theirs. They need to know it's theirs. And I can't think of any better way to do that than to say, you own it. It's yours. It's not just a company's piece of land and they let you use it. You own the company. You part own it. So therefore, the land is part yours. Right, now put your blood into it. Now you defend it. people will always defend, like, what's theirs. The problem with our country is people don't any longer feel that it's theirs. They've kind of given it away to politicians and businesses, and it's not really their country anymore.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's this, I think I said this on the Wessex Nomad stream, that people now assume, and they grow up in this age, assuming that everything else, everything is kind of taken care of. There's a system to, sorry to use that word again, to take care of everything and to own everything. And ultimately, we're sort of visitors or tourists in our own country. Because if it's not the government, then it's a corporation or it's a council, maybe a charitable trust that owns everything. So it's impossible for a little person to get a foothold in that, because it's all sewn up already. I think that's an assumption that people have of powerlessness, because they don't know how to. I mean, I remember at school, they didn't teach us about, you know, practical matters like this. You know, they didn't teach us anything that was really practically useful. So I think that's quite typical now. I don't think it's just me. I think it's a very standard thing that kids now, and young adults, they assume that it's impossible for them to really own something. And then that marries up with that statement from the WEF back in 2018. That's not entirely out of nowhere. It already marries up with the notion of life that a lot of people implicitly have. Not consciously, but subconsciously have, that they'll own nothing and yeah, they'll be okay with it. And what you're talking about is directly combating that and neutralizing that sense of powerlessness.
Well, I think on our website, it actually says, right, that you must agree that localism and nationalism, right, are there to combat globalism. So if you want to fight this, you've got to be invested, right? And you're invested in your country, and if you're invested in your country, you're invested in your land. A lot of people contacted me, like, through my YouTube channel, and were like, I'd love to do what you do, but I could never afford to buy my own land. Again, this is a way that, okay, you don't own it, right, outright, but this is a piece of land that you can go to at any time. No one can stop you going there. You can go and camp there. You can take your wife and kids there. Right? You can go and grow some food there. You're a part owner. So here you go. You might be on minimum wage, right? But you can afford a tenner to join. You can afford a tenner to buy your first block of shares. And in 6 months, it might take you 6 months to save up another tenner. Buy some more. Do you know what? You're doing something not just for yourself, but for people like you, right throughout this country. And I had an argument with people in the beginning where they said, well, surely someone who's paid in £1,000 should be entitled to more benefits than someone who's only put in £10. And I said, no, I'm not playing that game. I'm not playing the one-upmanship. I'm not playing for the rich boy down the road who says, oh, I've put in £1,000, therefore I want a gold membership card and I can use it 10 times. And poor Billy, who's on minimum wage, he can only come in once a month. No, we do this together as a collective, as a group, for us, not just for me, not just for you, but for us throughout the whole country. And if you can get your head round that, you're welcome. If you can't, it's probably not for you, really. If you're into, you know, I get more because I spend more, and I kind of get that because that's what you've been taught, this isn't the place for you, honestly.
What does that actually mean practically, though? That, you know, what are they complaining about? That they don't have as much influence? When they feel that they should have more influence, or what?
No, I think there's a lot of people who feel that, well, I've put in more, so I want more out. And I've just tried to say that, no, in this instance, you put in what you can, right? If you can afford to just to stump up £1,000, I applaud you and I thank you, right? But he can't. Like he's on minimum wage and renting a house, right? And he's got a wife. And at the end of a week, he's only got £6 left. And he's managed to get a tenner and buy £10 worth. That doesn't make him less than you, right? And it doesn't mean he won't continue to put in what he can, right? I'll have issue with the bloke who's on a £50,000 a year job, kicking his heels up, and has only put in a tenner. But that's not this situation. I wanted this to be open and accessible, right, to everyone. And I know there's a lot of people, there's a lot of young men in this sphere, right, that find it incredibly hard. They rent in a flat, right, which is £700 a month. They're paid £1,000. By the time they bought food and put petrol in the car, they're broke. And then they look at someone like me who's saying go off grid, and they were angry at me. They were angry, right, because they were like, excuse my French, right, but how the fuck am I ever going to buy a piece of land that's £20,000? I can barely save tenner. I can't do it. It's not going to happen. And they got angry, and I had to talk to them and say, listen, I completely get it. So here's a way. Here's a way that you can own part of it, that you can be as important as the bloke who's put in more. And the bloke who's put in more should help you. He should want to.
It's obviously a very altruistic kind of mentality that you're trying to encourage here. I'm just wondering, again, what is it that when they say that they'd expect more out of it because they've put more in, what is it that they're expecting out of it? That's what I don't understand.
Do you know what, Colin? It wasn't a lot, but it cropped up maybe 4 or 5 times. And I think it's an attitude, right? It's an attitude that's prevalent in society at the moment, which is, if I put in £10 and you're only putting in £5, then I want twice as much as you. And I kind of get that if you're buying something. Right. But this whole thing wasn't about that. Right. This is something that I'm trying to say, listen, we need to buy our land back, right, before these buggers get it and we can't even get on it. If we can do that, not only can we use it in the meantime, right, but we can become a very powerful, very wealthy organization over a short period of time.
Like a collective, I think, is the word here.
But we've got to do this as a collective. Now, if I've got a spare £20, I'll put £20 in. And if matey's got a spare £100, he can buy 100 shares. I've asked people not to put in more than £1,000. That's it. Which I think is a reasonable cut-off point. Now, if you want to put in more, you can. Right. If you just want to help it grow. But I'm saying, listen, let's try and keep it at that. If you can get to £1,000. And I've had old age pensioners saying it's going to take me 2 years. Right. But I'll get to my 1,000. I can't ask them more than that. Come on.
No, of course. So it's about putting together a collective amount of money, growing it all the time, and each person should not be expecting that they'll own twice as many shares of the land as someone who's put in half. Sorry, you're muted.
Twice as many shares in the company, maybe, right? But okay, and you're entitled to vote, right? But everyone's going to be entitled to vote as well. Right? Your voice will be listened to, right? I don't ever want this to get to the point where you think you're going to buy influence. No. If we're a collective, if we're the same, and if we're on the same page and doing this for the right reasons, you shouldn't be thinking like that. And, you know, I think that message has sunk into 95% of the people. And the other 5% that are in there jotting down names of mostly hope not hate reporters, so fuck them anyway.
I think we should bear in mind how certain other ethnic groups go about things, and they don't compete against each other within. I mean, obviously that does happen, but it's not the done thing, because they recognise that to work as a collective is, well, it is the best way to create power, to generate solidarity, and then exercise power out in the world. So in other words, they're not competing against each other. I think that's a crucial. Again, Anglo-individualism gets in the way. I have seen it myself many times, even in my time in the movement. And this is people who believe in collectivism, but then when it's their own assets or whatever, suddenly they're an individualist. And I think this is a big problem. I know it's a big problem, because I've seen it ruining projects, ruining collaborations time and again. I think it's a mentality that we absolutely have to get over. We can remain individualist in other ways and in other spheres of our life, but in this kind of thing, I do think that people should accept, I'm maybe not going to, maybe I will give more than other people, but that's because I can. And that's, it's for the greater good. The idea of doing something for the greater good is something we really need to get back to.
It's exactly that, right? And it is a collective. And if we're all striving towards the same thing, right, it makes complete sense. I don't think going forward it's going to be an issue. I really don't. It's really early days. It is only 6 months in. And like, it took us 3 months to kind of get the website working right and memberships so people could join. Then we had to get rid of a load of people, sadly, because they, well, I did have people going, well, I've paid my £10. When can I build my house in the woods? And I'm like, well, there's nothing to do with that. You know, and as this progresses, as the land is purchased, as people start to use it, right, I think you're going to see more and more people join. The strange thing is, I would love for this to be a way for a lot of people to go off grid. It will be a way that some can, right? Because we will be able to do this bit by bit. I mentioned earlier that in America, that there's a very similar organization started, Back to the Land Movement. It's based on Asher Logos' video last year, that came out about 3 weeks after I started the Woodlander Initiative, and I've plastered it everywhere because it is a brilliant video. I think you know. Do you know Arville?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he started the Back to the Land Movement. They've just bought 150 acres in, I think it's Arizona, in the Ozark Mountains. Exactly the same structure as we've got. Now, this was kind of freaked me out a bit. So I instantly looked at it when he started it, and I was like, hey, like, how have you set it up? And he was like, well, it took us a sort of 6 months to figure out how to do it and legal advice. And we've got a private members club, and then we set up a limited company, and then we linked the two. And I'm like, that's exactly what I did 6 months ago. And so it was really interesting. The beauty they've got in America is there's no planning laws or planning legislation where they are. So they literally bought 150 acres. And now they can just start building homes. And that's exactly what they're doing. Now, I would love to be able to do that in the UK. And who knows, as time goes on, we've got plans in the line for a couple of years down. There's ways we can get homes on the land, right? But it does take time over here. It's not something we can do straight away.
All right. Well, yeah. Let's close it off here, because I think it's we've covered all the topics, and it's been great. I really do think that this, when I first heard about this, it came out of nowhere for me, and I wasn't sure, but it immediately seemed like a good idea, and I looked into it and I've learned about it, and I do think it's a fantastic idea. I think it's one of those things where we've talked for years, and then somebody does something practical, and a lot of us don't quite know how to react because we're so accustomed to so much talking. And I'm not saying that that applies to anyone in particular. I'm just saying it was kind of the case for me. So I think that, but as I say, I think this is a fantastic idea, and I really hope that it takes off. 100,000 in 6 months. I hope that it doesn't slow down. I hope that it's like a snowball gaining pace, gaining power. I just hope that it goes from one strength to another.
I'm going to say one last thing on this. Like, we don't get very many victories on our side. This is a massive victory. I've had a look around over the last 2 or 3 years, right? For our people to come together, to raise £100,000 and to start buying our own land is a major victory, a massive step forward. Like, our own club, our own business, massive amounts of money. It shows what we can do. And we've got, 400 members. I would like 1,000, another 600 members. It costs, a tenner? Join up, right, and understand that together, right, we can actually make a difference.
Yeah, and there's a whole lot to say about that, but I don't want to go into it now because I've said it before. I just think we need to develop a positive attitude and a can-do attitude. This kind of stuff, it sounds like management speak, but we do. We need to learn to cooperate, to collaborate, and to trust, and to not let each other down. It's a big deal. It takes quite a change in mindset because we are accustomed to either things being done by the government or by our employer. That agency is a new thing for a lot of people. There are a few super chats, so we'll get to those now. Darby says, always appreciate listening to the Woodlander. Learn something new each time. Merry Christmas and good Yule to you both. Well, thank you very much, Darby. Essex Nomad says, Merry Christmas, Woes and Woodlander. A really engaging talk. Thank you. Excellent. Okay. Someone's asking about a podcast. Okay. All right. Thank you. That's very nice. Thank you for that super chat. Thin Red Line, Woodlander's initiative is very inspirational. That's good. Hinchfoot says, big love to Woodlander. Strew says, Merry Christmas all. Webster says, I hope this blackpilling discussed by you two doesn't demoralize us all listening to this in order to simply surrender to the anti-white tyranny in charge of the West. Good night, lads. I think that was someone who checked out when we were concentrating. We were focusing on how things were quite negative in the world at large. Pure Nomad said, Millennial is an institution. Thank you very much. MI5 Surveillance Van says, build our own. It all starts with finances, banking. It would cost £5 million to establish one. I think he means a bank. Atlas Rain Axis asks, can non-Brits participate in the Woodlander Initiative? For example, I live in America, but I have some British ancestry. Can I be a member?
Yeah. It's not shut to people that live abroad. As long as you agree with the principles set out in the on the website, and you'll see what they are. And there's a mission statement. You can read through that. If you agree with those principles, then you can join.
All right. And finally, MI5 Surveillance Van says, according to Charles, a commentator on UK Column, the UK government are incentivizing farmers to grow woodland instead of rearing cattle. The woods won't be for sale or usable by the plebs, by the general public. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah. We've got a major problem in this country. They switched our power stations from coal burning to wood burning. Drax, which is our largest power station, last year burnt 7 million tons of wood which is, if you want to equate, 80 tons is an acre of woodland. 7 million tons. Now, at the moment, they're buying a lot of that wood in, but I can guarantee you, and I know this from the sawmills around here, that used to sell lumber, but now all of that produce is going to wood-fired pellets, which go to power stations. All of them. They're buying standing woods. It's actually getting difficult to find firewood in the southwest, right? You can still find it, but it's getting harder. And the reason being, they're buying the standing woods, right, which have then been cut down, turned into pellets, which used to be a waste product. But these power stations eat wood at such a rate, right, that everything is going into there. And they're just buying American and Norwegian wood, right, and just burning it. And it will take centuries for some of these woodlands to grow back. It's not just fast 5-6 year woods they're burning. They're burning everything because they're not allowed to burn coal.
Oh, God. There's nothing that I can say about that.
As they call it, sustainable.
Sustainable. All right. And there are some super chats on here as well. Hold on. Okay. Homa Talk says, I just spent 3 weeks alone living on a beach in Alaska. And even that was good for the soul. Woody is living the dream. All right. And Black Pigeon Pilled has put in a few super chats. Thank you. In Woodlander's view, are squatters' rights in the UK still real? Or like the sovereign citizen, free man and the land movement, something which only finds you in a jail cell?
Yeah, the squatters' rights aren't really viable in the UK at the moment. I'm not going to go into the whole sovereignty thing, right? It fascinates me. But every time I look into that legal, lawful, sovereign man of the land thing, I kind of think I'm an inch away from learning some great thing which will really help us, and it never quite materializes. But that's not to say it's not there. I know people that are really into it, how the law works, how what the difference is between legal and lawful and sovereign. And I can't go down that rabbit hole. I'm too busy doing this. I'm too busy doing this, which is practical, and I can understand it, and people can benefit from it. You know, if it comes to them trying to take it away, then, you know, maybe that's the hill I stand on.
All right. Okay. And Woodlander recommended something I should add to my old... Hold on a second. Woodlander recommended something I should add to my old Holborn tobacco and licorice papers. Cherry something. I'm asking if Woodlander can please recall what this was so that I can obtain it. Thanks again. Good Yule. Cherry something for tobacco papers?
If he goes to a proper tobacconist, which is difficult to find now, you can buy black cherry flavoured pipe tobacco. You'll have to chop it up, right? Otherwise, it's very long strands, won't go in a roll-up. But if you chop it up, you can mix it with your old Holborn or your Golden Virginia, and it'll give you a beautifully mellow black cherry flavoured smoke. It's very nice.
All right. Okay, that sounds quite bespoke. What is your drink of choice during Christmas?
Rum.
Okay. Nice, concise answer there. Okay, and what are Woodlander's thoughts on the new policy to alter leasehold to shared ownership regarding property? I'm unsure if these changes impact land ownership, but it wouldn't surprise me. The policy to alter leasehold to share ownership.
Yeah, there's a lot of changes coming, and over the last 2 to 3 years in ownership. Be really careful with leasehold and sharehold. when it comes to your own property. It's a bit of a minefield at the moment, and it hasn't been sorted out, I don't think. No one's really sure what the implications are going to be. This is what I would say. If you're thinking outside of the box and what you can do to benefit yourself, there are things, there's changes they've made to planning legislation, which is for their benefit, which you can use. If you drop me a line on Telegram, I can run through some of these. Like, for instance, they've changed the planning on business premises. So you used to have to apply for a planning permission to change your office into living accommodation. You no longer need to do that. You've now got a permitted development right to change a business premises into living accommodation, which actually is quite handy. I could explain if you're interested in that sort of thing, but the shareholder thing I haven't really looked into. Drop me a line on Telegram and we'll chat it through.
Okay, and Black Pigeon Pilled asks if you could say his name.
What, Black Pigeon Pilled? It's as, yeah, I was saying earlier, yes.
Yeah, it's a running in joke there. All right, and then there's a big question from KN. What the Woodlander mentioned earlier about the pandemic and the very real and visceral atrocities that those in power inflicted upon people really brought back memories of the ridiculous and relentless propaganda involved in that operation. I vividly recall the death clocks in the corner of every mainstream media channel. The first time I saw it, I inadvertently burst out laughing in a room full of people at the brazen and cartoonish nature of it. All I could do was ask myself, what manner of person would make the decision to do such a thing under any circumstances, death clocks on the TV? The answer is becoming more visible by the day. Thank you both for everything you've done to bring clarity and sanity to our current circumstances in the West. Well, there we go. That's a nice sentiment there. Would you have anything to say about that?
I don't really want to discuss COVID. It's like, I totally get what he means. Like, it's done. But here's the one thing I would say. Everything we learned from that period, like everything that we thought might happen because of it, is actually happening. The difference is it's happening slowly in real time, right? So that you tend not to notice it. But everything that WEF were on about, everything those global organizations, the NGOs, were on about, is happening. So we need to keep an eye on that, because as much as we concentrate on demographics, which is very important, so is this as well. Both of those issues are important.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's end by summarizing the Woodlander Initiative and how fast it's grown, roughly what it is, and why people should get involved.
It's a British organization set up to buy land throughout the whole of the United Kingdom in order to benefit the British people. It's a membership club linked to a limited company. When you're a member, you can buy shares in that company, so you will actually own the land. It's a way that we can take back our land properly, legally, becoming an organization that in a few years' time could be a multi-million pound organization that has clout and is listened to. This is a route to power, and in a way that we can actually buy something that is of benefit for us all the way through. It's our land.
Yeah. And it's got 100,000 in 6 months. So it's doing well. And as I said, I hope it continues to do well. I hope this is just the start. If people are thinking about getting involved, they can go to the website. I think there are multiple ways that they can contact you directly. So and there's your own channel. They can go there. You're on Telegram. I do think that you should be on Twitter. I think that would be a big help. But I'll leave that up to you.
I am on it. I just don't know how to use it. And I keep telling people this, and they keep laughing at me like that. But it's a difficult. Oh, yeah. And I get on there and I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing. I don't know how to search for anything. I don't know how. What I need to do is get a 12-year-old just to show me how to use it, and then I'll pick it up, and then I'll be aware.
What we'll do is we'll meet up sometime next year.
Yeah, definitely.
I will show you it. I've even got it on my phone. So, yeah, because I'm a bit of a boomer with this stuff as well. But I've got it on my. I can show you how to do it.
That's a deal. If you show me how to use it, and then I'll be away, won't I?
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, this has been a really nice discussion. And I think it has been an eye-opener for some people. So, yeah, thank you very much for doing it. Thank you for all the super chats from various people. Please do take a look at the Woodlander Initiative. I've linked the website several times. I will add it to the video description. I'll be back very soon with the Homeland Institute. In the meantime, Woodlander, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you once again, Colin. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you to everyone who's watching the chat and everyone who's here.
Okay. All right. Excellent. See you all soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.